Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we continue our series on Project 2025 by focusing on promise number one, quote, restore the family as the centerpiece of American life and protect our children. Project 2025 says families comprised of a married mother, father, and their children are the foundation of a well-ordered nation and healthy society. Project 2025 would implement work requirements for food stamps, rename the Department of Health and Human Services to the Department of Life, and strip legal language for protecting gender equality out of every aspect of U.S. government. They also say the overturning of Roe is just the beginning. The Heritage Foundation-led Project 2025 plan lays out a comprehensive agenda to transform the United States into an arch-conservative Christian nation under Donald Trump and what they call Trumpism, the new conservatism. Project 2025 would dismantle the administrative state and ensure conservative rule for decades to come. It would affect all aspects of life and would be implemented by expanding presidential powers and by eliminating federal agencies. Project 2025 is backed by over 100 far-right organizations. You can find our past shows at kalw.org, click on News, and then Your Call. Joining us to discuss how they plan to, quote, restore the family as the centerpiece of American life are three guests. Nuala Bashari is a columnist and editorial writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. We will discuss her piece, This Right-Wing Lawsuit Against San Francisco is a Preview of What's to Come Under Trump and Project 2025. Hi, Nuala. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Melissa Gira Grant, a staff writer at The New Republic and author of the book Playing the Whore, The Work of Sex Work. We will discuss her piece, The Real Targets of Project 2025's War on Porn. It's not just about people watching porn. It's drag queens, trans people, LGBTQ library books, and more. Hi, Melissa. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thanks so much for doing this.
We're also joined by Julie Millican, Vice President of Media Matters, a progressive research and information center dedicated to monitoring, analyzing, and correcting conservative misinformation in the U.S. media. Media Matters has published a guide to Project 2025, the extreme right-wing agenda for the next Republican administration. Project 2025 aims to roll back civil rights and destroy the federal government, among other proposals. Hi, Julie. Thanks for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have all of you. Project 2025 is getting so much more attention. When Vice President Kamala Harris put out her first statement after President Biden announced support for her, Project 2025 was in a two-line statement. So it is really now getting out there. More and more people are learning about it. I'd like to ask all of you, when you look at promise number one, what they're calling restoring the family as the centerpiece of American life and protect our children, there is a lot in there and we've got time to talk about it. But I just wonder what really stands out for you. So Julie, why don't we start off with you, given that Media Matters has published an entire guide to Project 2025?
Thank you. Yeah. So what stands out to me in that, I think, is something that is an undercurrent of the entire mandate for leadership and Project 2025 that doesn't get talked about as much as some of the specific policy proposals that they have. And that is the influence of a very far-right interpretation of Christianity that really sets the stage and sets the tone for a lot of the policy proposals that follow. They really aim to center this interpretation of Christianity the center of the federal government, and they want to create a government that, you know, upholds what they view as Christian values. So there are a lot of ties to certain Christian nationalist groups, for instance, that were, you know, involved with the drafting of this mandate for leadership. And what it really does is take aim at both women women's role in society, LGBTQ individuals and couples, and transgender people, people who, you know, do not fall within the norms of what is considered the traditional views and the traditional roles of men and women, the traditional roles of gender, the traditional roles of families. And so that is something that they really throughout the proposal kind of, the guidebook, includes all of these proposals that like reinforce just this very narrow and a very strict definition of family and gender roles.
And again, we should say this is all out there for everyone to read. It is an over 900 page document, and you can go over all of it. In the Project 2025, it says, every threat to family stability must be confronted. What would you add, Melissa? What really stands out for you?
I would just jump on top of that and say every group that Nuala listed, the idea of this sort of white Christian family being the ideal that Project 2025 is trying to protect.
I'm sorry, Melissa, can you talk a bit louder? We're having a hard time hearing you.
Sure. I hope that that's better.
Yes, better. Thank you.
Okay, great. So I would just jump on what Nuala was saying and extend it that, you know, all of the people that Project 2025 sees as a threat to this white Christian value structure, to this white Christian family ruled by a white man, they define as pornographic or obscene. And so when, you know, there's been some very amusing pushback to Project 2025 saying, I can't believe these people are going to try to ban porn. You know, like we should just tell everyone that. And of course, they'll oppose Project 2025. But it's important to remember that they are defining pornography very expansively. Kevin Roberts, who's the head of the Heritage Foundation, who wrote the foreword to Project 2025's proposals. He also has a new book coming out that J.D. Vance wrote the foreword to. Mm-hmm. So these are people who are sort of in the mainstream, both of this effort and at this point, what is the Republican Party, who are going out there and saying things like library books are sexualizing our children. Sex ed is sexualizing our children. They're trying to recast any efforts to address queer and trans history and queer and trans people in schools as obscene and as dangerous to children. And in that, they aren't alone. I mean, this is part of a broader international movement that you'll see in Viktor Orban's Hungary, for example, that is trying to claim that there's this threat to children, threat to families, threat to the order of society. Sometimes they call it gender ideology. Project 2025 uses that language as well. They are trying to create scapegoats. And in a moment where we see increasing political violence, we need to take that really seriously. We've seen a preview of how this kind of ideology is playing out in certain states that have already adopted laws that essentially are doing Project 2025 right now in schools in Florida, in schools in Alabama, in parts of Texas. This has created an environment of fear, harassment, and violence for all of those people that Project 2025 considers not worthy of protection and, in fact, a threat to all of us. Of course, they're wrong.
As you point out in your piece, Project 2025 does not define pornography. It says porn should be outlawed. The people who produce and distribute it should be imprisoned. Educators and public librarians who purvey it should be classed as registered sex offenders. And telecommunications and technology firms that facilitate its spread should be shuttered. So you just have to wonder, what do they mean here when they say educators and public librarians who purvey porn?
I think they mean all of those people that they're already going after, you know, people who are teaching books that they find objectionable because they're honest about the histories of white supremacy and racism in this country, books on queer and trans people of significance to American history. Even a rainbow flag is considered objectionable to them. And I could see them casting that under the banner of pornography, and a teacher who allows someone to have that in their classroom as one of these people who should be punished, criminalized in this way. I think it's very difficult, of course, for the law to enforce all of these things. Really, what they're relying on is for people to comply in advance, to censor themselves, to be fearful of being inclusive. And I think that we're already seeing that. And, you know, this is sort of an opportunity maybe to kind of rehearse what it would be to push back on Project 2025 when they're already going after queer and trans folks as harshly as they are in certain places.
Nuala, what about you? What really stands out for you in Project 2025's promise number one about the family and protecting children?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. For me, what lies at the center of it is what is the definition of a family? My definition is certainly not their definition. I'm in a queer blended family, and there's a lot of legal limbo in there that honestly feels scary. I'm not sure what we can do in advance to protect ourselves. And while we have no idea or desire to move out of state, watching the states that we would feel comfortable living in shrink has been really scary. So it's hard for me to remove the personal with a lot of this stuff around definitions of family. But I think, you know, locally, San Francisco has a tendency to believe that it is exempt from a lot of these policies, and it's not. But I think about the pornographic aspect in particular that Melissa was talking about. That feels really scary to me, thinking about how this could affect our artists, our scholars, our drag queens, and whether or not there is legal merit there. I think fear is really, really powerful. So all of this could trickle down to our local level as well.
Well, if you'd like to join us today, we continue our series on Project 2025. You can find all of our past shows at kalw.org. Click on news and then your call. Today, we're spending the hour talking about the plan's promise number one. In their words, restore the family as the centerpiece of American life and protect our children. And again, this is all out there for everyone to read. You can find links on our website, along with articles from today's guests. Nuala Bashari is a columnist and editorial writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Melissa G. Grant is a staff writer with the New Republic. And Julie Millican is vice president of Media Matters. They have an entire guide to Project 2025. If you have any questions or comments about this specific section of Project 2025, again, it's led by the Heritage Foundation. Over 100 far-right organizations have worked on this massive document. And they say they've done this before, but they didn't have it in place in time for the Reagan administration. This time around, they want, if Trump wins or a future Republican president, they want this person to implement these policies in the first 180 days. They are ready to go on day one. That's what makes this different. So if you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have an email from a listener who says, at the start of the show, one of your guests mentioned Project 2025 stems from a far-right interpretation of Christianity. Can she give more details on the history of this sect? Can you elaborate a bit on that, Julie?
Sure. So one of the chapters in this book was written by a man named Russell Vogt, who was the former head of the office of the OMB. He did basically all the hiring during the first Trump administration and is now currently part of the Trump campaign. He helped set the RNC policy platform. He started an organization called Center for Renewing America, which is the premier, as he describes it, like far-right Christian nationalist organization in the United States. And they believe that the United States was founded as a Christian country, and that we should be following a biblical-based interpretation of our laws, and that the Bible should be the center of the governing of the United States. So they firmly do not believe in the separation of church and state. They believe in essentially what is a white Christian nationalist worldview, in that Christianity should be guiding the government, and there should not be the separation of church and state, and that that part, it is something that, like I said, it kind of weaves its way throughout the Project 2025's mandate for leadership. But it's also something that is like really prevalent within the MAGA movement. It's something that we, as an organization, we monitor a lot of right-wing talk radio, we podcast. And what we have seen is there's been a blending of the like Christian media ecosystem with the right wing media ecosystem. And they're very much singing from the same choir book, basically, in their really like restrictive views on race, gender, sexuality, and you know, with the women's role in the workplace. I mean, there's other things that, you know, we haven't kind of discussed yet that are all kind of tie back to this like Christian worldview. You know, they have this biblically based, I'm quoting right now, biblically based social science reinforced definition of marriage and family. But the partner organizations that have signed on to this have also gone further. There are at least 22 of the advisory board members for Project 2025 have like attacked or outright called for the end of no-fault divorce, for instance, meaning they would like, they do not want people to be able to get divorced because they want to, you know, they're having problems in their marriage or any various reasons. You have to find a fault. And this was something that was used for, you know, centuries, really, to keep women in abusive relationships, to make it impossible for women to, you know, be able to divorce husbands that are cruel to them. Like, there was a lot of difficulty to be able to have divorce, and they want to basically bring that back so that it's harder for people to get out of marriages that are not working for them, that it is harder for women need to be more financially supportive on like dependent on their husbands. And this all goes back to this very Christian, you know, like right wing version interpretation of the Bible, that like women are to be subservient for men. The only appropriate marriage is one between a man and a woman. And it's really something that like shapes the entire view around reproductive health, you know, gay rights, et cetera. And it's throughout, you know, like I said, it just peppered throughout this guide.
Melissa, would you like to add anything about what this far right interpretation of Christianity actually means?
Absolutely. It's incredibly dangerous. And I think after January 6th, this danger should feel very palpable to people. You know, when we're talking about Christian nationalists, white Christian nationalists, these are people who believe that God has ordered them and given them the roadmap to rule others, to create a Christian nation. The kinds of flags that people were carrying into the Capitol on January 6th, like this appeal to heaven flag, it's a white flag with a pine tree on it. You see it also outside House Speaker Mike Johnson's office. This is something that has mainstreamed. Leonard Leo has flown this flag. Or I'm sorry, I'm not sure if it was Leonard Leo or Samuel Alito's wife, Martha Ann. Forgive me. But people
Samuel
who are
Alito.
In...
The,
it was Samuel Alito. Yeah. In allegedly his wife, but you know, it right. was their house together. This is something that has rapidly mainstreamed. You would think after January 6th and how hand in glove this sort of Christian nationalist ideology is, you know, Trump is God's candidate. He should be ruling. It doesn't matter if he won the election. A lot of the election denial and this kind of stop the steal movement is wrapped up in Christian nationalism as well. It's beyond just, you know, we should win because we have the better ideas. It's not about that at all. It's, you know, we should win and we should have won because God is on our side. And they're very successful in sort of inverting things that you would think don't sound Christian nationalist at all. So, for example, this group Alliance Defending Freedom, they've brought a lot of cases before the Supreme Court. They are one of the main groups behind Project 2025. A lot of the family language is just direct out of things that they have been saying for years in court briefs and in front of the Supreme Court. They view what they call religious freedom as the freedom to express their Christian religion through discriminating against queer and trans people, against same-sex marriage, against providing abortion or even contraception. They are trying to sort of like, use this mantle of religion as a way to use the state to discriminate against those that they have ideological conflict with or are trying to use to create a broader ideological conflict. None of this stuff is incredibly popular, right? But they can't actually win on the merits. So they are, that's, I think, why we see this like kind of alliance between Christian nationalism and these broader efforts at eroding democracy that we saw on January 6th. Like, they are not pushing a popular message. And so in order to succeed, they know that they have to take control of and erode our democracy.
Nuala, what would you add?
Not much. That was, excuse me, a really thorough explanation. I think it is just such a powerful narrative reading it. I wish in many ways that the left had a rhetoric or belief system as solid to point at, because I do think people really want something to follow. But when I read a lot of the details in this, some of these proposals just seem so extreme that I do wonder how popular they will be if they're implemented, not just for the left, but for the center and the middle, because it is really an extreme shift from where we are right now.
Well, to your point, if you look at their one of their goals, number three, promoting stable and flourishing married families, families comprised of a married mother, father, and their children are the foundation of a well-ordered nation and healthy society. Now, I'm reading from Project 2025 directly. Unfortunately, family policies and programs under President Biden's Health and Human Services Department are fraught with agenda items focusing on LGBTQ plus equity, subsidizing single motherhood, disincentivizing work, and penalizing marriage. These policies should be repealed and replaced by policies that support the formation of stable married nuclear families. Working fathers are essential to the well-being and development of their children, but the United States is experiencing a crisis of fatherlessness that is ruining our children's futures. They go on to talk about physical and sexual abuse, incarceration, teen pregnancy, poor educational outcomes, high school failure. The list goes on and on. And I think, Nuala, what is so, I guess, ominous about all of this is that some of these issues that they highlight are real issues that we need to solve, but nothing in Project 2025 would actually solve these issues. How about raising wages, ensuring that families have access to healthy food and healthcare and a good education where money is not an issue, where they have a safe place to live? I mean, none of those, and those are all proven solutions, but none of those solutions are in Project 2025.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, you know, there are a lot of populations in this country that are struggling because of decades of systemic oppression, and they really do need targeted support to stay healthy, to stay housed. And so that is in many ways why DEA policies are in place, why affirmative action policies are in place, to be able to allocate resources to populations that are struggling specifically. And we've seen that really challenged in San Francisco recently. There was a lawsuit filed last November, alleging that several of its guaranteed income programs violated both state and federal affirmative action laws. So of those, two have been kind of centered and have a bit of merit, unfortunately. One was a guaranteed income program for transgender people that gave 55 people who were low income $1,200 for up to 18 months. And the other was called Abundant Birth, which gave 150 pregnant Black and Pacific Islander women $1,000 a month for the duration of their pregnancy and for 6 months after their birth. These are really important policies, specifically in San Francisco. In this city, transgender people are 18 times more likely to experience homelessness than the general population. And half of all maternal deaths in the city each year are Black women. So these are populations that really need support, but they are being challenged legally and likely successfully. So the trans program has already shut down. The participants were given 1 month notice, and Abundant Birth may have to remove the qualifiers that it has in order to continue providing resources and support for people.
This is such an important story, Nuala, and I'd like to talk more about it after a break. Nuala reports that a lawsuit in November claimed that because San Francisco's programs prioritize benefits for people based on gender, race, and ethnicity, their use of public funds is discriminatory. The suit was filed by the Californians for Equal Rights Foundation on behalf of two plaintiffs. Nuala writes that when she dug into the small organization behind the suit, and the Dallas-based lawyers it retained, she found connections to right-wing conspiracy theorists, former California politicians, and ties to the Heritage Foundation, which created Project 2025. I really hope you can take the time to read this piece. It is so important, and we'll talk more about it after a break. Nuala Bashari is a columnist and editorial writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Melissa Giwer Grant is a staff writer with the New Republic, and Julie Millican is vice president of Media Matters. On today's Your Call, we continue our series on Project 2025 by talking about the authoritarian plan's promise number one, restore the family as the centerpiece of American life and protect our children. And they say that when you're talking about American life, you're talking about families comprised of a married mother, father, and their children. That's the foundation of a well-ordered nation and healthy society. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we continue our series on Project 2025 by talking about the plan's promise number one, to restore the family as the centerpiece of American life and protect our children. Just to remind you, the Heritage Foundation-led Project 2025 plan lays out a comprehensive agenda to transform the United States into a conservative Christian nation under Donald Trump and what they call Trumpism. This is the new conservatism. Project 2025 would dismantle the administrative state and ensure arch-conservative rule for decades to come. It would affect all aspects of life and would be implemented by expanding presidential powers and by eliminating federal agencies. It's backed by over 100 far-right organizations. You can find our past shows at kalw.org. Click on News and then Your Call. Today, we're joined by Melissa Giwer Grant, a staff writer at the New Republic. Julie Millican is vice president of Media Matters. And Nuala Bashari is a columnist and editorial writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Nuala, just to spend a little more time on the story that you wrote, the right-wing lawsuit against San Francisco is a preview of what's to come under Trump and Project 2025. So again, they're criticizing families that do not have a man, woman, and children. And they say that rolling back abortion rights, well, I shouldn't even say rolling back, it's banned now in almost half the country. I mean, Vice President Harris makes a point that the overwhelming majority of black women live in the South, and with the exception of Virginia, there is an abortion ban in every southern state. So as we are speaking, women, girls, people who are pregnant are being forced to have children that for a variety of reasons that is none of our business, that they don't want. This is happening right now. And so here's a plan that would actually help pregnant women. 3 years ago, as you report, San Francisco launched an experiment to give 150 pregnant Black and Pacific Islander women $1,000 a month, no strings attached, for the duration of their pregnancy and 6 months after the birth. There have been so many studies about these programs, and they show that they are life-changing on so many levels. As you report, Nuala, half of all maternal deaths in San Francisco every year are Black women, even though they make up only 4% of births. And yet, here comes a lawsuit saying that this program should not be implemented because it prioritizes benefits for people based on gender, race, and ethnicity. So can you give us the details? What is going to happen to this program because of this lawsuit? And as you say, many similar lawsuits to come.
Well, I think it will likely be shut down because the case does have merit unless the definitions of who can be included as part of this guaranteed income program are expanded. San Francisco, I think, is going to continue to be targeted in this way. We really, as a city, lead the country with a lot of progressive social experiments that are promoted on national news. And so we're targeted accordingly. The organization that filed this suit is called Californians for Equal Rights. They're based in San Diego. And they learned about these two programs, the guaranteed income program for pregnant women and the one for transgender individuals, when they saw them on national news. So that is one of the reasons that I think we're going to see more of these issues being targeted locally. So I started looking into the group that filed it because I was thinking, you know, why did the San Diego-based group file this lawsuit that is likely going to be successful? And it was an interesting journey down a rabbit hole. This group was launched in 2020 after Prop 16, which overturned California affirmative action laws, passed. It's pretty small. And I was looking at their tax filings, and in 2022, they only brought in around $250,000, which is not an enormous amount considering what they are tackling. And looking at their backing, that's where the story got really interesting. So the law firm that is arguing this case with the San Francisco City Attorney's Office is huge. They're called the American Civil Rights Project. They're based out of Dallas. They have filed a ton of amicus briefs against trans rights across the country. And the advisory board for this small organization that is suing the city has some really powerful figures on it. So James Lindsay, who's a famous right-wing conspiracy theorist and author, is listed. So is former U.S. Congressman Tom Campbell, Michael Gonzalez, who's a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. So that led me to Project 2025 and thinking a lot about whether these sorts of small lawsuits that are eroding these policies in local jurisdictions are going to be targeted more. And I think it's a no-brainer to say that they absolutely are. You know, I looked around the 900-page plan, and I didn't see any direct references of affirmative action. But of course, there are so many ways in which that would be impacted, squashing DEI programs or all of its blacklisted terms, such as gender, sexual orientation, gender equality, gender awareness. You can really see where this is going.
You report that statewide here in California, more than 12,000 people receive money through guaranteed income programs. Governor Gavin Newsom has been an ardent supporter. 44 mayors in California joined a network advocating for an income floor, and more than 70% of voters in California support a federal guaranteed income program to provide hundreds of dollars a month to those living below their county's median income. This is according to polling from earlier this year. And yet we're seeing these lawsuits, and you say that they're just going to continue. And I think, Nuala, the point that you're making is really important because, you know, even if Trump does not win in November, it's not like Project 2025 is going in the trash bin, because a lot of what we read in Project 2025 is already being implemented in Republican-controlled states. And we've had people on from places like Tennessee and Florida, and they said, don't think that just because you live in California or a very blue state, don't think that these policies are not coming for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think despite the fact that there does seem to be an overwhelming support for these guaranteed income programs in California, that doesn't really matter, unfortunately. You know, Mayor London Breed sent me a statement. She really supports these programs. She's standing behind them. And yet the city attorney's office is fighting tooth and nail to defend these programs. And at least on a couple of them, will likely lose. So I do think it is already happening. I think it will get bigger if Project 2025 is implemented. It says that the Justice Department should immediately use, and I quote, the full force of federal prosecutorial resources to investigate and prosecute all state and local governments, institutions of higher education, corporations, and any other private employers who engage in DEI efforts. So it's going to trickle down 100%. There are going to be a lot of eyes on local jurisdictions implementing these policies. And when that happens, San Francisco is always looked at the most, I think.
Right. Melissa, what would you add to that? How Project 2025 will trickle down to states and cities if Trump does not win in November? I mean, and like I said, many aspects are already trickling down. But how do you see this playing out?
I'm going to use an example that folks may be familiar with. Earlier this year, the Supreme Court heard a case brought by one of the groups behind Project 2025, Alliance Defending Freedom, who I spoke about a bit earlier. This case was Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus the FDA. If they had been successful, this case would have made mifepristone one of the two medications used for medication abortion. It's been FDA approved for more than 20 years, is incredibly safe. They wanted to essentially take it off the market because a group of physicians that they assembled said they were being injured by people who might be their patients someday coming to an emergency room after complications from taking mifepristone. This is outrageous. I mean, the Supreme Court rightly kicked this back and said, you know, this is there is no standing for these physicians to make this claim. But one of the things in this suit, one of the things that was argued in the lower courts and entertained at the Supreme Court by Justices Alito and Thomas, is this idea that's at the heart of the anti-abortion parts of Project 2025. This was sort of, it's like coming out. They believe that the 1873 Comstock Act, which was an anti-obscenity law passed before women could vote, it should be enforced today to ban mailing mifepristone or other forms of medication abortion, because this law said that you couldn't mail anything that could cause an abortion. This hasn't been enforced in a very long time. It's very difficult even to find examples of it enforced in that era, because it was an era where we didn't even have these kinds of abortion laws that we have right now. The whole landscape even of pregnancy and how people understood, you know, when viability was completely different in the 1870s. But they feel like they've kind of found this like magic trick they can pulling out this old law that not a lot of people are familiar with, including not a lot of people working on abortion rights. So I feel like if they had been successful at the Supreme Court, you know, they would have already achieved part of Project 2025. They weren't successful there. But, you know, to your point, like, they will keep coming back. I think this case is going to come back. And one of the things that has been unfortunately sort of misreported about Trump and abortion and Project 2025 is this idea that Trump believes that abortion should be left to the states, that the anti-abortion movement believes abortion should be left to the states. But what they also are saying is there's already a national abortion ban on the books with the Comstock Act, and Project 2025 directs the Department of Justice to begin enforcing this law on day one. This would criminalize people using the mail, sending or receiving medication abortion. They think that they could get away with that. Obviously, it would be fought out in court, but that is a national abortion ban that would be implemented in every state. It is a national ban that already exists on the books, as they argue. It is debatable if that's even legal, but they will try. And I think that's kind of the theme with this, is if they don't succeed with a Trump presidency, they're not going anywhere. They're going to keep trying to pull the levers of the courts, the Department of Justice, whatever they can do to force these things through that nobody wants.
To talk more about this, they have a section in Project 2025 called the Life Agenda. And Julie, at Media Matters Guide to Project 2025, you all did a very good job. You've got a drop-down menu, and then you can choose a topic. So I just chose reproductive rights. So let's talk about this for a bit, because it's very important. Project 2025 says the Office of the Secretary should eliminate the Health and Human Services Reproductive Healthcare Access Task Force and install a pro-life task force to ensure that all of the department's divisions seek to use their authority to promote the life and health of women and their unborn children. HHS should return to being known as the Department of Life by explicitly rejecting the notion that abortion is healthcare, and by restoring its mission statement under the strategic plan and elsewhere to include furthering the health and well-being of all Americans, quote, from conception to natural death. So can you talk more about Project 2025 and their plans when it comes back to even rolling back reproductive rights even more?
Yeah, for sure. So Project 2025 attacks reproductive rights from several angles, including they want to remove the term abortion from all federal laws and regulations. They not only want to reverse the abortion pill approval, which we were just discussing, and they want to limit what they call mail order abortions. But the other aspect about the Comstock Act that I think doesn't get talked about as much is that the courts may not interpret that to apply only to abortion pills. It's the kind of the thing that I think everybody's pretty clear on, that it would ban mifepristone and other abortion pills. But it actually says that it would outlaw the use of of sending or receiving any object that could be used for an abortion. Now, the courts could interpret that to also apply towards surgical equipment, for instance, that is being used to perform surgical abortions, which are less common these days than medicated abortions. But it still exists. And it's also the procedure that's used for treatments of miscarriages, for retained placentas after birth. It's the same procedure. And that may even be impacted if they, depending on how the courts would interpret the Comstock Act. And given the makeup of the current courts, I would say that it's certainly possible that we could end, even surgical abortions as well. The other things that it would do is it would punish providers by withdrawing federal health funding. For instance, they want to defund Planned Parenthood. That's been like a call on the right wing for decades. This would, Project 2025 and the Mandate for Leadership policy proposals would actually do that. They would also bring back like conscientious objector exemptions to allow providers to deny abortion care or other forms of reproductive health that they, maybe have a disagreement with. They would restrict clinics that provide contraception and STD testing. And then, one of the other things that we've done at Media Matters is gone a little bit further and looked at like what the partner groups themselves have been saying around reproductive health. They're very open about wanting a national ban, for instance, against abortion. But there's also other things like the Heritage Foundation, for instance, has a really long documented opposition to IVF. And it's rooted in this like far right Christian belief that, a zygote essentially is a child. And so any sort of destruction of an embryo of any kind of fertilized egg would be tantamount to murder. They supported the Alabama Supreme Court ruling this year that would have effectively banned IVF in the state. And they've put out really draconian IVF policy proposals on their own for an ex-GOP president. They, like many of their proposals, would mirror this anti-abortion playbook and reinstate trap laws, which are basically laws that would like impose medically unnecessary restrictions on IVF or providers. And it's designed to make the operation of the business like too burdensome to continue. And some of the other things that partner groups have done is they've argued against surrogacy. Again, Heritage is also opposes surrogacy, and they do that in ways where they're making kind of bogus claims or suggestions about like that surrogacy will like negatively impact children's mental health because they believe children should be raised by their biological mothers and fathers. And you see some hints of that in Project 2025, in the Mandate for Leadership. There's a lot of concern about, the concern trolling, as we call it, around children's mental health being impacted by not being raised by their biological mothers and fathers. And a lot of people kind of interpret that and look at what, Heritage has said on their own around surrogacy to be like, hey, they're opposed to surrogacy. Why might they be opposed to surrogacy? Again, a lot of these groups are pretty open. They don't like the fact that gay couples use it to have children. They don't like the fact that like single women use it to have children without being married and without, having a husband. And so there's just the policy proposals around reproductive health are extreme. And in their own spaces, they go even further. And I think it's something everybody should be really alarmed about.
To your point about the groups that are working with Project 2025 and have signed on to this, this is so important. At Media Matters, you all do such a great job of monitoring right-wing media. What are your thoughts about, first, just mainstream media? Because Project 2025 is getting so much more attention. People Magazine even has a long spread about Project 2025. The View was talking about Project 2025. What are your thoughts about mainstream media coverage of this? And then, Julie, how is this being covered in the far right media?
Right. Well, on the mainstream side of things, I would say I think it's a good thing that there has been a lot more interest in coverage of this topic, because it is something that was like flying under the radar for a really long time. This proposal was put out last year. This is not something that was even recently released. How it came on our radar was because of our media monitoring, actually. Steve Bannon, who is currently in prison, but is also a big right-wing media star who is very close to Trump and was once part of his administration. He was hosting people who were affiliated with Project 2025 so they could talk about it and promote it. They were especially excited about aspects of the what they call destruction of the administrative state, which is like in their minds rooting out the deep state that got in Trump's way the first time around from fully implementing their agenda. And now they want to, you know, be able to change the rules so it's easier to fire career civil servants so they can just stack the government with loyalists. Now, that's how it became on our radar. And we've been following it for quite some time and had been sounding the alarm about the extreme policies that were in this proposal and the people who were supporting it. And I'm glad that the media has started to take notice of it and draw more attention to it, because the more people learn about it, the more they're alarmed and the more they're opposed to it and the more they understand the stakes. And the right wing spaces, it's interesting. So as I mentioned previously, like I think one of the things that's been kind of the rallying cry for them is this idea that they can just like root out their enemies, get them out of the government, weaponize the Department of Justice to like launch a retribution agenda. Like those are some of the things that they're the most excited about, frankly. They know that it's bad policy to want a national abortion ban, so they're not talking about that that much. You know, they know that it's bad policy to talk about how they basically want to eliminate queer people from public view and, you know, and you know, make it like that it is illegal to have books about transgender people in libraries and, you know, all of the sorts of things that could happen if some of these policies came out. They understand that that stuff's unpopular. So if they do talk about it, they're talking about the parts about their little fantasies about getting the revenge on the liberals that they detest, frankly. And more recently, what we've seen is that they're just distancing themselves from it altogether. Because again, as the media covers this more and as celebrities, draw attention to it, the more people become aware of what's in it, the more repellent these ideas become. And you see it. You see Trump trying to pretend that he has nothing to do with this, despite the fact that he implemented 64% of the mandate for leadership during just his first year in office, and he bragged about it. And he's trying to distance himself from it, despite the fact that 31 out of 38 advisors have some sort of connection to him and his administration. The J.D. Vance, as was mentioned earlier, the man that he has picked as his vice president, has wrote the foreword to the Heritage Foundation president Kevin Roberts' new book that's going to be released soon. I mean, these people are deeply tied. And the policy positions that they're pushing are ones that either started under Trump or are ones that Trump has openly embraced. So this idea that there that Project 2025 doesn't speak for what would happen in a Trump administration is just false. And I think the media could do a better job of drawing those connections. They are doing it. And I think they need to be explicit about it every single time they talk about it, though, that this is, you know, despite what the distancing that's happening on the right, that they're trying to pretend that this isn't their thing. It is their thing. It is being run and advanced by people who have like, this is the entire right-wing movement. This is the Heritage Foundation has its hands in everything. Like there's no reason to think that this wouldn't be the exact policy proposals that they would be implementing on day one. And I think the more people know about it, the better. And I think the media is doing a good job and starting to pay attention to it. And I hope it continues.
We are almost out of time. I want to read two questions and then we'll get final thoughts. One listener says, I've heard about Project 2025, but this is the first I'm hearing of these frightening details. How are organizations responding to this? Art writes, can you talk about the impacts of Project 2025 on San Francisco's LGBTQ community? How can we protect that community? So your final thoughts, Melissa? We have about a minute left.
Sure. I mean, I think those are all real important questions. I lived in San Francisco for a long time, was part of the queer community there. I am very scared myself and don't have enough time to get into it here, but there is some good grassroots work going on. I would suggest folks check out the Stop Project 2025 organization that's based here in New York and has ties to ACT UP and groups who've been doing this work for a real long time. There are people who are pushing back on this.
Thank you. And Nuala, what are your thoughts? We have about a minute left.
Yeah, I think that those are really good points. And also just building awareness. Not a lot of people that I talk to really know what Project 2025 is beyond the headlines or how it could impact them. And there is an incredible amount of energy and organizing in San Francisco with the LGBTQ population. So I think there is the potential for a strong resistance, but people really need to understand how it could impact them first.
And your response to these questions, Julie?
Yeah, I agree that the more that people are aware of what's going on and what the plans are, and the more that people understand the stakes, frankly, heading into a big national election, I think the better. And so to everybody's point, there's great groups on the ground that are organizing against this. And there's also a lot of like national organizations that are trying to put out guidance and resources and stuff to support people to fight back. So I would suggest looking into those as well.
And we do have time for one more question. Philip writes, certain aspects of porn may be reprehensible, but to ban it is the thin edge of the wedge that will eventually take away freedom of speech. Soon enough, political satire will be outlawed, as it is in many countries, in the name of decency and order. Since you wrote about this, Melissa, do you want to take that one? And we've got about a minute now.
Sure, I'll try to be brief. I think that's exactly right. They're trying to create a situation where people are so fearful that maybe political satire would be treated under the umbrella of pornography. Maybe something critical of the government would be considered under the banner of pornography. This is how they are trying to wedge people apart from one another. It really doesn't stop or even start with the porn industry. It doesn't stop or start with sex workers. It's about using that and the stigma of that to try to wedge people apart from one another in a moment where we need solidarity more than anything.
Melissa Jira Grant is a staff writer at The New Republic. Her latest piece is The Real Targets of Project 2025's War on Porn. It's not just about people watching porn. It's drag queens, trans people, LGBTQ library books, and more. Nuala Bashari is a columnist and editorial writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. We discussed her piece, This Right-Wing Lawsuit Against San Francisco is a Preview of What's to Come Under Trump and Project 2025. And Julie Millican is Vice President of Media Matters. They published a guide to Project 2025, the extreme right-wing agenda for the next Republican administration. The plan is to roll back civil rights and destroy the federal government, among other proposals. You can find these pieces at kalw.org. Click on News and then Your Call. Julie, Melissa, and Nuala, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.